The following is a presentation of the Town of North Hempstead's Project Independence and WCWP. Welcome to Project Independence and You.
Welcome to City Talk Radio here on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org. This is Project Independence and You. I'm your host, John Ryan, and my co-host today is Janet Entine.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. I haven't been around for a while, Janet. It's wonderful to have you back.
Thank you so much.
And before we go to our first guest, I want to update you on Project Independence. Project Independence is the Town of North Hempstead's initiative to help seniors age in place. And we do this from many, many different avenues. We have transportation to and from shopping, transportation to and from medical visits. Every day of the week, there is a program, whether it's on physical activity, mental issues, mammograms, you name it, there's something going on in this town every day of the week. And the way to find out about it is to call 311. That is the number. You call 311 and tell them what you're looking for. At this time of year, there are volunteers to do gutter cleaning, which people, it's amazing. I mean, because seniors can't, it's more dangerous for a senior to take a step stool and try to clean a gutter that's clogged than to call 311 and ask somebody to come over and help you. Taking your air conditioner out of the window and then you hurt your back. It doesn't make sense. Call 311 and somebody will help you out. Our first guest today is Renee Silver, and I know Renee from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock, where I met Renee on the art committee. And in the middle of the conversation at the art committee, somebody was talking to her about her book, which I didn't know she was an author. And the book is And Yet I Still Loved France. And actually, she gave me a copy of it, and I haven't finished it. I started going through it, but it is... It's amazing. It's amazing how there's undiscovered, we go to Iris, golden nuggets in our lives that you don't appreciate, and it's an accidental meeting that brings it to our attention. Renee, it's a pleasure, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
And what I'd like to do is, before we get to the actual book, okay, I want you to tell us about Renee. I mean, we were talking about knitting. You should see the outfit on Renee right now. And she's a knitter.
It's magnificent.
Oh, it's just, it's, you know, I would assume it was bought in Bergdorf's and she made
this. At least.
At least, exactly.
It is really extraordinary and unique and beautiful.
Thank you.
How did the book come about? And, you know, there's just so many different questions asked, but let's start with how did the book come about?
The book came about in the following way.
Okay.
Many, many, many years ago, I was contacted by someone who had been given my name to do some research. She was doing a book called Shoes for Amelia, a children's book. And in the course of asking me questions, I was to be the model for this little girl in this book. And in the course of asking me questions about it, she became more and more interested. And by the time Shoes for Amelia was published, she asked me, would I consider her writing my story, or at least participating in writing my story. And we began the process. This was a woman who at that time lived in Manitoba, Canada, and she would have me on the phone for 45 minutes and then maybe 5 weeks later send me a handwritten page or something. To put it very briefly, it was a very slow, tedious process. After 14 years, my little sister, who was a part of my story, had passed away. My husband had passed away. And I finally said to her, Connie, I think I'm going to finish this book myself because I'm getting on, too. I'd like to see this book published before I die. So that's how the book came about.
Okay. And it's wonderful. And obviously, I Still Love France is the story of your life during the war.
Yes.
And that, you know, these are tough questions, but can you just go into a little bit of, I mean.
Well, the yet in that title examines the fact that while I loved and still love France, it was a country that was not kind to my family and to me and caused me great, great grief. My parents were Saarlanders, which was identified as Germans because the Saarland no longer existed. And thus we were foreigners in France. And when the war broke out, we were immediately considered as dangerous aliens, you know, part of the fifth column. And we were picked up along with every other available foreigner and brought from the north of France, where we were, all the way south and then west to a place called Le Camp de Gurs, which was a huge concentration camp that had originally been built to receive the remnants of the Republican Army, the Spanish Civil War people, and the International Brigade. And we were at this camp, which was a pretty rough experience. When France fell, we were, quote, liberated and moved on. We were at that point with my grandmother and two cousins who had come to us after the war. After Kristallnacht in Germany. And they had papers to go to the United States. And they went to Marseille at that point to await transportation. While we had family in the United States who would have gladly welcomed us, we were determined that, you know, this was our country. Why would we leave France? This is our country. This is our homeland. Of course, we had no idea that the new French government then in the unoccupied zone, the Vichy government under Maréchal Pétain, was going to become extraordinarily antagonistic towards us, and that our lives were going to be in great danger. It did not become apparent immediately. It became apparent first to me in June of 1942, when I was publicly humiliated in my school by my school principal, who refused to give me a particular prize that was to be awarded for excellence by the Maréchal, because I was one of that race that had already caused France so much so many problems and so much harm. After that, it was evident that it was not safe for us. My sister and I were sent away to what has become a very famous town, Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, where we were hidden by the Protestants of that region, along with many, many other children, although since we were hidden, we did not know any of the other
children. How old were you at that point?
At that point, I was 11. My sister was 9.
I think, not to interrupt you, but I am. I think it's so amazing that this was happening to Germans, so to speak, in France. When, you know, until I saw this, I was like, I had no idea. I really didn't.
I mean, unless
you're a history person.
I did not either.
I thought concentration camps was strictly in, you know, Germany, and of course it was against all the Jews. And in here you have in France, they had the German. It's shocking.
It was not just, this concentration camp of Gurs, where we were brought in 1940. There were Belgians, there were Gypsies, there were Czechoslovakians, there were people, there was anybody who was not French, and not necessarily Jews.
Okay.
It was foreigners. It was the fifth column. The French were extremely, extremely frightened of any sort of intrusion. And it was ridiculous, because here we were a family of seven, an 83-year-old grandmother, my father, who was totally paralyzed on the left side from a World War I head injury. We were about as dangerous to France as a newborn kitten. And we loved France, but nobody cared.
In the camp, were you all together or they separated?
In the camp, the women were in one section, my grandmother and the children. We were in one section. And when it became and the men were in a men's section. When it became apparent that my father, because of his paralysis, could not get down to sleep on the floor on a straw mattress, they put him into a special section, a hospital section, which had been set up by the International Brigade and the Spaniards. And eventually, my mother, who was a little woman of great, great courage and who insisted she had to go visit her husband, was given permission to visit my father, and we accompanied her. And this is where we met not only the Spaniards there, but this extraordinary group of international intellectuals, doctors, journalists, writers. In our case, we met mostly doctors who were taking care of the Spaniards who were dreadfully, dreadfully injured and maimed. I mean, there were times when my mother just held us against her to cover our eyes because she didn't want us to see people dragging a man on a little cart without arms and without legs. It was it was horrible. But they were very kind to my husband, and it was actually a fascinating experience for us to meet these Spaniards, to be taught some Spanish. Our first words were, "Yo tengo hambre," was the first thing they taught us. And all these people from this international brigade who were, you know, fascinating idealists.
The part that's I'm picking up, you know, is a terrible, terrible situation. And I'm not saying you don't have scars from it, but as you're telling the story, you're telling it with a positive vent, a positive tone that, you know, there was some nice, that's what I'm sensing from it.
Well, the title of the book shows your optimism, but it is when you hear the details of your experience, it's quite breathtaking.
Well, actually, Gurs, when we got to Gurs, my sister was 7 and I was 9 at that point. And we were truly children. We were unaware of the fact that we didn't have enough to eat. Mm-hmm. We were unaware of the fact that the only thing we had to eat was some sort of something called pois chiche, which is chickpeas undercooked. And we thought they were great because they made perfect marbles. And we had a lot of, you know, and we, I think basically my sister and I were extraordinarily fortunate in having just fantastic parents, mm-hmm. very, very loving and very brave. And we really were not terribly aware of the tragedy we were a part of. Besides which, this was in the Pyrenees. We had a view of the Pyrenees, which are spectacular. And we met all these very, very interesting people.
The point you just said, too, wonderful parents. That's hard. You know, I'm a parent, obviously. I don't mean obviously, but I am. And for your mom and dad to see a 7 and a 9-year-old going through this, even though you were playing with the chickpeas as a marble, their heart was breaking, saying, you know, their toy is their food later on this afternoon. I mean, what kind of a life is this that we've been thrown into?
Well, it was also hard for my parent, for my mother, because the, you know, sanitary conditions were terrible. We had lice, we had fleas, we had bed bugs, we had rats running over our faces at night. My mother would sit up, you know, to make sure they did not run over our faces. At one point, the Red Cross came by to put these kerosene caps on us to get rid of the lice. And, you know, both my sister and I, being very fair and very tender-skinned, developed these huge, huge blisters all over our head. I guess it took care of the lice, although the nits remained in our hair for number of years after that without, you know, being able to actually turn into lice. But it was still an embarrassment. Even once we got out of the camp and our teachers examined our heads, you know, they could still detect
the nits. That's amazing. Actually, you know what? Before we continue on, we're going to take a break. You're listening here to Renee Silver, who is the author of Yet and Yet, I Still Love France. And it's on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org. We'll be right back.